Now on Documentary on News Talk, producers Sean O'Boyle and Maurice Kelleher tell the story of the first 10 years of the Science Gallery, a game-changing cultural space in Dublin that redefined the relationship between science, art and culture. In Science Gallery, 10 years of art meets science.
My name is Michael John Gorman. I was the founding director of Science Gallery in Dublin. About a year before the planned opening, I was hired as the director. And at that time, there were some initial ideas about what the Science Gallery would do. It was somewhat, you might say, a traditional approach to science communication, in that I remember one person wanted to have Maxwell's equations of electromagnetism written on the walls of the gallery. And there was this the idea that the public would come in and learn about fundamental principles of science. But when I came on board, I was coming with a different set of experiences. I'd worked in a number of exhibitions where one brought together scientists and artists and engineers and designers. So I thought, wow, here is a chance to really have a space that is that kind of petri dish for bringing together these different groups, and a changing space where one can be constantly tapping into concerns that people have, and then bring together people from different disciplines to explore them together. Like many projects, it took a certain amount of time to bring everybody on the journey, and there was a lot of skepticism in the early days of the Science Gallery about this whole idea of art and science colliding.
I'm Ian Brunswick. I'm the head of programming at Science Gallery, Dublin. Science communication is a funny term because it means a lot of things to a lot of people, and it's changed rapidly over the past decade or so. Science communication has grown to mean a lot of things, and I don't know, to a lot of people it probably means more almost public relations, promotion, campaigns, and that doesn't resonate as much with me because that kind of harkens back to, I think, a late 20th century one-way model of authority, experts, or influential industries broadcast science to the masses and don't listen. And Science Gallery, I feel, is the kind of science communication institution that says science and society have a complex relationship, and science communication studies and interacts with that. It's easy to take it for granted today that there are mainstream cultural people, phenomena, media that have science ingrained in them, like Big Bang Theory, XKCD, you know, brands that appropriate scientific and technological concepts. The fact that Elon Musk and a bunch of other people in tech industries are household names, it's easy to take that for granted. It was not that way only a couple decades ago. And if you had pitched the Big Bang Theory, like, I think 20 years ago, you probably would have been laughed at. A primetime show about people who study physics, you know, would be preposterous. So science as an aspect of culture and as a subculture became cool in the 2000s, for whatever that means, for better or worse, and trendy and appropriated. So that's problematic. But at the same time, science communication initiatives, science outreach, science museums, they kind of around 2005, they'd been coming off a long time of being pretty either dry or kiddy. And there wasn't a huge amount of compelling engagement with young adults and adults. One way to put it is, some people say science museums are for kids, contemporary art museums are for adults. And it's easy to take that for granted, but why is it that way? And I think that was one of the founding questions of Science Gallery. Like, why can't we have scientific exploration for young adults, for 22-year-olds?
My name is Lynn Scarfe. I am now the director of the National Museum of Ireland, and I worked in Science Gallery as part of, I suppose, the founding team. So I came on board in late 2006, early 2007, and was the director at Science Gallery for a period of time as well. I was program manager and education and outreach manager, and you know, covered marketing and comms for a little bit as well. So yeah, a little bit of everything over my 11 years in Science Gallery. Well, it was quite interesting because I think I came in and was sort of overwhelmed in some ways by, like, just how compelling the idea that Michael John had around art and science coming together and what his vision for the Science Gallery was. And I was, if you like, I was coming into that mix with this very strong background in community engagement and how I suppose, you know, arts and culture could be a really strong approach to exploring contested areas. I feel kind of really strongly that arts and culture gives us space to think. I think that it gives us sometimes the tools to think as well. I think that that is a very important function of arts and culture. And because of how critical I think that function is, it has to be accessible and open to everybody, because I would say that it serves one of the most critical functions of our society, in that it gives us space to do that. And if it's only people from very specific areas or backgrounds or, you know, contexts that get to engage in art and culture in that way, then we're not having the kinds of conversations that we should be having. The work itself doesn't speak back to you as such. You know, the artist has developed the work and they want you to engage with the work, but they have an expectation that you come with your own personal emotions and ideas and that's allowed for. And that's, I think, the really exciting piece. And I think you can see that, you know, that happened a lot in Science Gallery, you know, in terms of the kind of different sort of work that we did. And a lot of people at the beginning were, you know, worried about the controversial element perhaps of what we're doing, like the more edgy element, because obviously we set this very specific target audience, which sort of released us from having to do the sort of fun science world. And that gave us the freedom to produce, you know, exhibitions and shows that pushed a little bit more. Now, I do think what was crucial to why the Science Gallery was so successful with that is the mediators. So from the day we opened our door, we had these incredibly engaged, intelligent, you know, interesting individuals who were willing to act as conversation starters, as communicators, as human connections between the artwork and the audience. That human connection was really the kind of critical piece about that. And that's what made the Science Gallery really unique.
My name's Leah O'Flanagan. I am the operations manager, Science Gallery Dublin. So I've been here for over 11 years now. A reason for me kind of stepping away from the art world was because it was a commercial gallery. You know, it was commercial. You're working, obviously, with a really nice product. It was works on paper I worked with mostly, doing art fit out for people who, you know, have the money to buy them. So you're kind of, it's an exclusive thing in a way. I think when I got a bit older, I was like, this notion of giving back, you know, that people have, that, you know, is more of a purpose in their job, that is giving back to people. And because, you know, Science Gallery is a free entry model, offering all these amazing programs, that was important to me, you know, that it was a space that was accessible to everybody. It's such a huge part of my life. Like, it's such a... And, you know, I still really enjoy coming to work every day. But those early years, like, that crazy startup mode was just... Like, we kind of knew... I guess we were onto something when opening night, it was like maybe... It was a queue of maybe 500 people snaking down Pier Street. We were like, whoa! And the opening hours were 4 till 10, because the opening exhibition, Lightwave, you know, it needed to be dark. And it was a 3-week show. And, you know, we just didn't really realise what we'd unleashed on the public. When we opened that night, just hordes of people came in. We'd no barriers, we'd no walkie-talkies. Like, an exhibit got knocked over in Gallery 1, which is the first space you come into. You know, it was just kind of, oh my God. We had an exhibition, Infectious, where there was a kind of one station was... microscopes that the public could look at different, you know, infections or viruses, or, you know, and there was an arsenic slide. And I got a call. I was in a bar up in Dublin, just not too far from here, but I got a call at, like, when the guys were closing up saying that the arsenic slide was missing. So this was like, oh my God, you know, there's going to be some kind of breakout in Dublin. What have we done? And it was Michael John who rang me, actually. It was those kind of the panic calls, the panic, you know, that was real. It was this first part of a place where you could come in and even look at something like that, which was so amazing for the public.
The Science Gallery was a really fast-paced project. You have to imagine that it was a 12-month lead-in. We had to finish the building, develop the entire program, the vision for the gallery, all of the exhibition plans and everything. And it was just a frenetic pace. And really at the beginning, there were just three and then four people running this whole thing. So it was a very small team, but a wonderful team. I mean, the kind of team that you dream of, and everyone completely committed to the project.
I think that in the early days, Science Gallery had a lot to prove. We had to prove, or even when I was a visitor, it seemed like Science Gallery was trying to prove that science exhibitions and experiences could be cool. They could have a premium, slick feel. They could have solid branding. They didn't have to look like poster sessions at a conference that somebody threw together the night before, you know, in PowerPoint. It was the, why can't science feel more like an experience at the Tate than it does like an experience at a poster session at a conference?
Our opening exhibition was called Lightwave, and it was looking at light from the point of view of art and science and design. And we had everything from Willie Williams, U2's lighting designer, with an installation to a wonderful experiment involving bees and the color vision of bees with a scientist called Bo Lotto. We were planning to have Lightwave be a festival to be followed by our first exhibition in the gallery, which was on the topic of the face, the human face. It was called Future Face. And then very close to the opening, planned opening time of the exhibition, suddenly the curator of the exhibition pulled out because she wasn't happy with the conservation conditions in the gallery. So we had a bit of a crisis on our hands because, you know, Lightwave was meant to be a 2-week festival followed by an exhibition, and the exhibition had just vanished before our eyes. So we scratched our heads, and then we immediately said that Lightwave was extended by popular demand. So we had signage put up, and we changed the program and issued a press release so that it was going to continue for another month. And then we raced to try and find a substitute exhibition. We had seen the work of these artists in the UK, Susie Freeman and Liz Lee, who created these amazing installations with pills, with medical pills in textiles. And we really liked their work. So suddenly the idea was born of having an exhibition called Pills, Which Ones Have You Taken? And this was literally put together in a matter of 4 weeks. We called up the people, Liz Lee and Susie Freeman, and we said, we asked them how much of their work they could share with us. And they told us what they had. And then we said, well, we're sending over a van on Thursday. And they didn't believe us at first, but then we sent over the van to pick up their entire work from a building in the UK. And then we opened the exhibition 4 weeks later. So it was an absolute race. But that was kind of the spirit of Science Gallery in those early days. And actually, that exhibition was amazingly well received, it got fantastic response from visitors. And we had the serendipity that it opened at the same time as the whole debate was emerging about antidepressants and whether they worked. And we used that opportunity to have a big discussion in the gallery about, do antidepressants work, with some of the key scientists involved in the research, and that got a lot of public interest. There was also a kind of a darker moment when I think it was one of the tabloids, like the Mirror, published an article claiming that junkies had stolen all the pills from Science Gallery, which was completely fabricated and allegedly came from a source within Trinity, where they concocted the story that people using the methadone clinic across the road on Pier Street had come in and stolen parts of the exhibition.
Human Plus was one that I really enjoyed for lots of reasons, where we kind of explored the future of our species just because it gave us a huge amount of kind of space. I actually really, you know, we did a show called Surface Tension, which explored the future of water, which I now, it's funny, sometimes you think about some of the shows that we did and you think, actually, we were almost too early, you know, like Surface Tension in some ways. When I think about that show now, it's the kind of show that needs to happen again. Hack the City was one that I really enjoyed because we had huge ambition around Hack the City, and probably our ambition was probably a little bit stretched beyond what we could deliver, but that was, you know, still 2012, so early days of Science Gallery, when we just kind of went for it. I mean, for that show we were like, we had a shop front on Capel Street, for God's sake. You know, when I think about it now, I think, how did we sustain that? But anyway, so Hack the City was a great show. Grow Your Own, Surface Tension, Design and Violence, particularly what we got to do in our reinterpretation of that theme was creating a space where people could bring in objects and tag them and talk about them in the context of violence and design. And I think that's really interesting. You know, our whole series around Lab in the Gallery and what that sort of opened up in terms of collaboration, scientific research, how it belongs in a public space.
My name's Sean O'Boyle. I was the research coordinator at Science Gallery Dublin. So part of my work was supporting actual real research and experiments that happened within Science Gallery. And the Lab in the Gallery program was really interesting because we would have these entire shows dedicated to real research. So one of them, for example, was around life logging, how people capture all of the data about their day and their bodies. And we had this really interesting thing where we had scientists come into the space, we had a lab downstairs in the gallery, and they would do week-long residencies and essentially treat it like their own lab. And visitors to the gallery would take part, they would contribute their data, their ideas, their opinions. And so it was a really interesting way for visitors to the gallery to meet researchers, to see how research works, and also to like take part in it. And it was great for the researchers because they got to collect data and do experiments. So the Lab in the Gallery program evolved then, where in any exhibition, no matter what the theme, we would look for opportunities to have a real research experiment in the space. So, for example, during an exhibition I worked on called Seeing, which was all about different ways that we see the world, either ourselves or using technology, we had a really interesting experiment by a group in Trinity, and the experiment was led by a researcher called Katja Zebrek. And what she was looking at was how people interact with characters in a virtual reality environment. So visitors would come in, put on a VR headset, and then they'd be in this virtual room with a character. And each week, Katja would change what this character looked like, and she measured how people interacted with the character. And then it later got published in a scientific journal with all of the data that was collected during that exhibition. And what I find most interesting about that experiment in particular is that it not only has applications in, you know, virtual reality and gaming, but also in psychology and mental health, because virtual reality is being used as a treatment in those fields at the moment. So it really helps inform those sorts of projects as well.
I don't understand why other places don't do the themes that we do. And I'm constantly fascinated by really important societal questions that are at the intersection of culture, science, technology, art, design, that get overlooked by so many exhibition spaces, probably because they don't have a history of engaging with those, or they're cautious, or they feel like they don't have a remit to engage with. Like, could a natural history museum engage with racism? You know, like it doesn't immediately seem obvious that they could, but there must be some way in which they could look at the parallels between the natural world and biases or something like that. So I'm sometimes frustrated that more institutions aren't more thematically engaged and instead focus on topics that are comfortable or they have a history of, because we know that the history of museums is not radical, is dwindling in kind of social relevance to a younger audience, and is precarious economically. So there's no quicker way to make sure that your entire industry kind of fades than not trying to make yourself more and more relevant.
An exhibition always starts with a really strong idea or a concept. And, you know, recently Science Gallery has had themes that really connect with something in society or culture. So things like privacy or perfection or intimacy or trauma. And when I worked there, the focus was sometimes on more scientific stuff. So we had an exhibition called Blood. We had one called Fat. So those were very biomedical. But also we had exhibitions like Illusion, which looked at... we actually had magic as one of the core themes in that, which was a lot of fun. We had exhibitions like Strange Weather that looked at climate change. So it's a real mix, but it always starts with one key idea. And then that idea gets developed by the team. So there'll be a team at Science Gallery working on that months and months out from the actual exhibition, thinking, okay, what are the interesting conversations that we can have around this theme at the moment? You know, what do people care about? What really matters? What's happening in science? What's happening in art? And then we try and create a bit of a framework around that idea. And then the next step is putting a call out for artists. So we'll, you know, tell people this is the theme we want to explore, and we'll send it out to networks of artists all around the world and say, you know, tell us your ideas. Maybe you already have an artwork that would fit with this theme. Maybe you have an idea for an artwork that we could help you produce. And we could have, for any exhibition, we could have hundreds of proposals from artists and scientists all around the world. And then the next point, or the next stage, is taking that to our curatorial team. So depending on what the theme of the exhibition is, we'll put together a group of advisors that help us shape what the content will be. So they'll all be like experts in their field or people with really interesting perspectives on this idea. And then we get them all together in a room. We go through all 200 or 300 submissions. By the end of it, we'll have sort of like a short list of artworks. And then that's an exciting moment because the exhibition is really starting to take shape.
You're listening to Science Gallery, 10 years of art meets science on Documentary on News Talk.
So what I love about Science Gallery and what I always loved about working there is that whenever we had a new theme to explore, it always really challenged how we thought about these things. So for example, we had an exhibition called Fat, and it turned this idea of fat as a bad thing around, and we looked at how, you know, lots of athletes have really high fat content, you know, ice swimmers, you know, sea swimmers, long distance swimmers, and we looked at, you know, fat is not a bad thing in the body all the time. We had an exhibition that I found really interesting as a science communicator, and that was Strange Weather, and it was about climate change, and climate change is one of the toughest things to talk about because it can feel so overwhelming to people. It feels like, you know, such an impossible, massive thing to deal with, and people can just get really detached from it because it's too big. And what we did was, or what the team on that exhibition did was, they framed it around weather. So instead of like having a big show on climate change, we talked about something that Irish people love talking about and everyone actually loves talking about, which is the weather. And it just created such an easy way into conversations, and we looked at, you know, how weather and climate are related. Another exhibition I really liked was Fail Better. And the reason I like it is because it talked about failure, but in a really useful and constructive way. So failure is a really important part of science. It's an important part of life. And the exhibition was filled with all of these objects that represented failure in some way. Like one of the objects in that exhibition was actually provided by Sonia O'Sullivan, incredible Irish athlete and Olympian. And she had her like ID, her pass from the 1996 Olympics, which didn't go well for her. but actually became a really important part of her life as an athlete and her psychology moving forward. And we got to actually explore that with her in an event, which was really nice. And then the nice thing about that exhibition as well was visitors came in every day and wrote about the last time they failed or messed up or wished they'd done something differently. And that really made the visitors part of the exhibition, which I really loved.
We seem to have this uncanny ability to anticipate topics before they happened, in the sense that the big exhibition about water that we did, Surface Tension, opened just as there were huge floods in Dublin. Then we had the infectious exhibition open 4 days before the swine flu broke out, which was a huge story and all over the media. And we had these giant biohazard signs all over the gallery. People immediately thought that Science Gallery and Trinity had been hit and infected with the swine flu. And there were with these signs saying, stay away. What it allowed was for us to become a public focus for the whole discussion about the swine flu and bring together the researchers, Kingston Mills, the influenza expert, and other experts to discuss what's really going on with this swine flu and how does it work, how is it propagating, and so on. And that rapid response nature of Science Gallery, I think, was something which made it very different from a lot of other museums in the landscape.
When we did Strange Weather, another funny story, which is a show about climate change, and the opening night it was really hot in the middle of the summer and the air conditioning broke and we had to, there was water pouring through the ceiling, so we just had a mediator stand under it with an umbrella and everybody thought it was part of the show. So I think Science Gallery in some respects is a great example of just thinking on your feet and being kind of value and vision led, so that when the ceiling leaks you think, how do we turn this into an installation as opposed to just leave a bucket under it? Well, it's really interesting because I think that Science Gallery is and remains and I hope continues to be a very edgy space. I hope it always took risks. I think having moved to the National Museum and now being in an institution that has over 4 million objects in its care, that as a national cultural institution is an amazing thing. We hold those objects really on behalf of every person in Ireland, and that's an amazing honour. But that also in some ways is a slight constraint, because before everything else you've got to put the collection ahead of everything else, because that is the reason that you're here. You're here to, you know, to protect and preserve the collection and to offer new and interesting ways to interpret that collection to our visitors. Science Gallery never had that constraint of a collection, and I think that that always enabled it to push boundaries a little bit and to shift its resources very quickly and swiftly into new and interesting ways.
My name is Maurice Kelleher. I work across dance, theatre, performance and film. I was commissioned to make a film installation for the trauma exhibition at Science Gallery Dublin. Hysteria was a large-scale projection. The starting point for the film was the invisibility of pain, the idea that mental anguish is invisible. And when a person is traumatized and the distress reaches such a critical level, the distress bleeds out into their body, into behaviors and into movement. And I took those behaviors and those movements of extreme distress as a sort of choreographic starting point for what was a physical performance captured on film and projected into the gallery at nighttime. The starting point for Hysteria was I'd seen existing archival medical footage that's 100 years old. It's from Netley Hospital in the UK, and there were soldiers who presented with what we would now term post-traumatic stress. They would have been referred to as having shell shock, like it was a disease, and it's only now that we understand more about trauma and that we have terms like post-traumatic stress, and we understand that what these men actually were so incredibly distressed, that distress bled out into their behaviour and their movements. These men are so troubled, it's such a moving film to see, because they are so obviously distressed to such a level that they literally cannot contain it. So their movements are really pronounced, and it's this kind of dance of distress. And that for me was the starting point. I projected this archival medical footage into the space and onto the body of a dancer. It is essentially a dance film, but when I say dance, it is not dance in the way that we traditionally think of dance. It's more like physical theatre or a physical performance for the camera. The performer is using the movement that's in the 100-year-old footage as a starting point, and it turns into a sort of choreography of distress. I propose to the gallery that we only project the film at night to really challenge the idea of a traditional exhibition, traditional exhibition times, traditional exhibition viewers, and challenge this idea of you sort of have to go into the exhibition in order to see all the pieces. If you went to the exhibition during the day, you'd see the signage for the piece, where there was an empty frame and the signage announced that something would appear here later on. So there was a sense of, what's this going to be? And you had to come back when the gallery was closed to see what would appear there. I wanted something that could just really reach through the glass and just capture people on the street, on the night bus, in a taxi, walking home drunk, running for the train, and exhibition goers. One thing I wanted to do with the installation was highlight the limits of language when it comes to talking about trauma, because trauma is a lived experience and it's a very particular emotional, psychological, physiological state of being, and it's very, very easy to slap a label on that or to slap some diagnostic language on that. But when you saw the installation and you saw the integration of 100-year-old footage of men with shell shock and a performer embodying trauma, when you saw all of that happening, my hope was that it would highlight that trauma is a really visceral, lived experience, and language just doesn't come near.
My name is Kathy High, and I'm a visual artist, but I work in a lot of different mediums and sometimes call myself a bio artist. Blood Wars was part of the visceral exhibition, and one of the things we did was we set up a science lab inside the gallery that was kind of an ad hoc temporary lab that people could both enter sometimes but also look through the windows to observe the work that we were doing. Blood Wars is a project that came out of my interest in studying immunology because I have autoimmune diseases, and I'm very interested in what the process of the immune system actually does for us human animals and other animals. And so I had been looking at this in many different ways, but with Blood Wars, I was focusing on blood and trying to see what would happen if we put white blood cells between two different individuals together, would they fight or not? And this was the kind of premise of the project. The thing that I was interested in also was looking at the language that we use around the immune system, which is in the public, not necessarily in science, but in the public, often rendered very kind of with very militaristic terms. We aggressively go after invaders in our body, our white blood cells do, or our immune system. And so what, you know, I was interested in how we could maybe think through that terminology and whether it was true or not. The Blood Wars was held as a competition, which was modeled after, well, the World Cup tournament. So this is how we modeled it and had different people fighting each other, their blood fighting each other. And then the winners would continue against the other winners. One thing I would love to have achieved with Blood Wars was to sort of bring people into the lab in a way that they began to be curious themselves to do similar kinds of projects. When I came into this project, I had no experience working with separating red blood cells from white blood cells, for example, or applying fluorescent stains and working with a microscopy to study the cells in a time-lapse manner over hours to see what they did with each other. And the fact that the cells actually didn't always kill each other, sometimes they They just mutually died or became friends. So there was all kinds of permutations that I had never anticipated. And I think this was the wonder of being able to come into a science situation or a science experiment of my own making with the help of scientists who could help me read it. And I felt like I was on a big learning curve, and I would hope that other people who approach the project might be able to see that they too can enter into this engagement with science with a kind of cultural questions and understanding of what we would like to do as artists and scientists together.
Science Gallery, the concept in Dublin, came after the building. So we're in a building where it's a building that goes into a triangle. It's a shared reception. You walk into the back of a staircase. There's very little wall space. It's pretty poor gallery space, to be honest. You know, there's a lot of glass. But the things we've had in here and, you know, how we change the space every time an exhibition changes is kind of amazing. You know, we've had bees in here. We've had a Guinness dress way back in the early days. The space here, Gallery 4, the very first exhibition, had a piece by the artist Anna Hill with the Northern Lights. We've had crickets. We've had lots of
crickets.
We've had lots of fish as well. I had to drive down to Wexford one time to a trout farm with my mother and a bucket to collect a lot of trout that were needed for an exhibit. It's funny with working in a space like this but having a really creative team, the amount of like favours that need to be pulled in are just unbelievable with some of the stuff we're trying to do, you know? Calling people up for the strangest things. I have a friend I went to school with as a guard in Pierce Street, and, you know, I have really been on to her many times for things we've needed or permissions we've needed or can we do this?
What's the weirdest thing you've had to ask for?
The firearm stuff was, you know, for design and violence. You know, we needed a kind of gun license, and we had to get it like a cabinet for the. We had an AK-47 in the space. Then we had a plant coming through. You know, we had a lot of customs issues with that. This plant hybrid that was coming through from the Department of the Environment, was it going to get through customs?
What was the issue with that plant?
It was like, wasn't it like the DNA of a human was mixed in with this plant, and like, which, like, no, it wasn't. Edunia, I think, was the name. And like, Department of the Environment having huge issues with this, and we weren't going to let it in. And it was like very close to opening day, but it was great because, you know, Michael John was great pushing the boundaries, and he was like, right, well, we'll just put up the letter from the department. You know, that's where the exhibit should be. Like, this is why it's not here, you know. So that was fun. The crickets.
What did that involve?
That was a very complex installation, but many of them escaped actually, and people had to rescue them around the gallery. You might remember that. Yeah.
What else?
We did have, some of the bees got out as well, but I think, you know, when we were 3D printing insects, you know, because they were, you know, this source of protein for people to eat. What was that?
It was edible, wasn't it? It was here.
Yes,
actually.
It was just here, actually, where we're standing. I think that, because that's a number of years ago, I always thought we were a little bit ahead of the curve with things like 3D printing and that, which is all kind of, people think it's cool maker stuff now, but we were doing it 6-7 years ago, you know? We talk about Science Gallery being a world's first. Like, it truly is a world's first. I really believe that. There was nothing to compare to, you know, with no benchmark.
I'm very proud of the fact that a small group of people managed to not only to build that, but to make it into something which other cities around the world aspired to and wanted to have for themselves and build on themselves. Even in the early days, there was the conversation quite frequently that if this was successful, you know, this was an experiment. It really was an experiment. But if the experiment was successful in Dublin, why wouldn't a similar approach work in other cities where you have a university in an urban center? And for me, it's been very exciting to now see, since I moved on from Science Gallery, how This idea is thriving and is now under the leadership of Andrea Bandelli. There's Rotterdam that has joined up to the network, and Detroit, and I believe several more in the pipelines.
In some ways, I think the impact exists more out of Ireland on a global scale with the other network members. I do feel sometimes it's a little missed locally.
My name is Andrea Bandelli. I'm the executive director of Science Gallery International. The international aspect of it came because there was interest from other universities to do something similar. After all, for a university to have, it's not common for universities, first of all, to have spaces for public engagement. Some universities have museums or visitor centers, or like Trinity also here, the Book of Kells or rooms, and so, but those are rather exception. And in almost all cases, they would be about the past. So there are seven, Dublin, then there is Science Gallery London, then there is Science Gallery Venice, which is developing a range of programs and workshops and initiatives at the moment. Then Science Gallery Bengaluru in India. Then there is a Science Gallery Melbourne, which is being constructed as we speak. They will open at the end of next year, so in between 12 and 18 months. Then there is Science Gallery Detroit. It launched their first exhibition last year. It was called Hustle, which is like the motto of Detroit. And then the seventh member is Science Gallery Rotterdam. And we just actually completed an expression of interest, a call to universities worldwide to identify the next few members of the network. It is so important to stress the fact that we live in one world. I think we are redefining the meaning and the role of having indeed a global perspective on the world, and it's extremely fascinating to be part of that.
My name is Anne Mulrooney. I'm the director of Science Gallery Dublin. I suppose from a distance, Science Gallery always interested me intellectually, just because of the pieces, the way that they were put together, the depth of thinking behind them, and also it was work that you wouldn't see or come across in Ireland normally. So any time that I came here, I left inspired by the thinking that was evident, and being here and understanding more in depth how Science Gallery works, I think what is most important, as I see it, is Science Gallery's capacity to put narrative around complex issues or complex areas. And I think that's an incredibly valuable skill, and the team here do it extremely well. So ideas that might be challenging or difficult or just complex in terms of maybe the science and the research behind them are presented in a way that is really engaging, that's experiential, and that allows people space to actually understand and question and find their own position. And to me, that feels like it's very intentional, first of all, that's how the gallery operates, but to me, I also think it's very unique. It's a safe space to be able to speculatively think about what the consequences of decisions or developments might be. So it's in a vanguard. It always has been, but I think that over coming years, its perspective and its capacity to do that, to create those conversations, will become increasingly important to a wider sector of society. For us to be fulfilled as human beings, we need a creative outlet, we need creative expression, however that's found. And that, to me, seems like a basic fundamental human right. In fact, I'm pretty sure that access to culture is one of the human rights. So it's incredibly important and recognised as such. Then there's this other kind of societal value as well. So my firm belief is that involvement in culture, art and creativity actually leads to increased efficacy, increased well-being, innovation, enterprise. You know, when they look at studies of fine art graduates, Nesta did a study a number of years ago that I found hugely influential, and it tracked graduates of fine art for years after they left college. And what they discovered was a certain percentage of them became artists, but all of the rest of them became innovators, entrepreneurs. They had this risk-taking capacity, they had creative and lateral thinking, they had their own vision that they were willing and to commit to and driven to discover. And so I think that from a societal perspective, that creative impulse has incredible value. Governments don't fund luxuries, really. They don't fund nice to have, they fund essential to have. And right across the world, culture is funded by governments because it has all of those roles to play. It actually, in so many ways, can be measured and shown to be incredibly valuable, and also in building stronger societies. So to me, it's a no-brainer because I've always worked in culture. I believe it intrinsically. I also see it. I know that particularly when you're watching impacts on young people, you can see how access to art and culture actually allows for transformative effects on people's lives. And I speak from experience there, because the reason I'm sitting here in this chair now talking to you is because I had a transformative experience of art at a young age that really made me want to devote my life to working in that area. And I think that that's often the case. And if you allow young people to have that opportunity, I think what it creates is an incredibly resilient society.
Science Gallery, 10 Years of Art Meets Science was produced, recorded and edited by Sean O'Boyle and Maurice Kelleher. The programme was funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland with a television licence fee.